My dear brothers and sisters, in the providence of God, we are members of a worldwide community known as Christadelphians. And all of us are believers as a result of the life and the labours of one man, John Thomas, who we are sure was raised up by God to unearth the original truth from the mists that had enshrouded it over the centuries. And so it's therefore appropriate that from time to time we should review the heritage that he has bequeathed to us. And we'll see through his life the hand of God shaping all his circumstances to enable him to recover the truth. So let's summarise the talk that we're going to give this evening. First of all, we're going to think about the Thomas family, because there's a lot of interesting features about that. Then his early life, then his emigration to America, and the incident that made him resolve to search for the truth. And then we're going to consider his searching for and finding the truth. And having found it, he then contended earnestly for the faith. And then lastly, he spent the last few years of his life supporting the believers and the communities that he had established. So first of all, the Thomas family. They were in all probability descended from the Huguenots, who had fled from Holland from the persecution of the Protestants in the 16th century. They settled in Bristol, where in 1738, a mariner called Joseph Thomas married Sarah Moy. In the St. Nicholas Church parish records is the entry there. You can see the one up from the bottom. Joseph Thomas and Sarah Moy, married on the 16th of April, 1738. They were a prosperous and, as it turned out, very intellectual family. They had 9 children, of which 2 are relevant to our study this evening. On the left-hand side, we have Moy Thomas, born in 1740. He was a lawyer. Now, by that time, the family had inherited Joseph Thomas's brother's estate in Rotherhithe, and they had all moved up to London. And there, Moy Thomas, his son, took up the law. He had a son, another Moy Thomas, who was a lawyer. And you can see how the word Moy occurs repeatedly in the Thomas genealogies. They retain the name of their grandmother and mother, and that goes on right down even to this present day, apparently. Then Moy Thomas had a son, William Moy Thomas. He was quite a well-known Victorian figure. In fact, he ended up as secretary to Charles Dickens, the author, nonetheless. And we were actually able to get a picture of him. He was an author, a journalist, a theatre critic. He was secretary to the owner of the Athenaeum, and also to Charles Dickens. You see, he was a person who moved in quite elevated Victorian circles. And a current writer says of him, he was a writer of rare acumen and large knowledge of books, plays and actors. And he was, in fact, the second cousin to brother John Thomas. Going further down the genealogy, we come to 1952... where there was another Moy Thomas that we've been able to trace. And it's reported of him that he had a first-class brain bordering on a genius. So you can see then that the Thomases were very intellectually intelligent people. Now, reverting to the other side of the family, the John Thomas, who was born in 1954, this was Brother Thomas's grandfather. He was what was known in those days as a dissident. In other words, he was a religious belong to a religious organisation that was opposed to the established Church of England in both doctrine and practice. You see, after the Toleration Act of 1689, freedom of religion was allowed in England, whereas it hadn't before. And this gave rise to a lot of people who set up their own organisations, and these were known as the dissidents. We know that John Thomas was a dissident, because dissidents in those days could not be buried in churchyards. They weren't allowed a sacred burial, so they were all buried in the London ones, at least, in Bunhill Fields in North London. And that was a cemetery set aside for dissenters. And that's where Brother Thomas's grandparents and others of the family are buried. He was in quite well-known... excuse me. He was in quite well-known company there, because also buried in that same cemetery are dissenters such as John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, Daniel Defoe, who wrote Robinson Crusoe, and William Blake, who was also another dissenter. He was the author of the hymn Jerusalem. We're going on to back to John Thomas. He had a son plus seven other children who took holy orders. And so we will call him the Reverend John Thomas. And he was, in fact, our brother John Thomas's father. He married Jane White in 1804. He married in the St. Mary's Church, Rotherhithe. And you have a picture there of the church and the inside of the aisle, which apparently has not altered from that day to this. And in the parish register, there is recorded the marriage of Reverend, as he became, John Thomas, to his wife. Now, Reverend John Thomas had eight children, the firstborn of which was our John Thomas, born a year after his marriage to Jane White in 1804. He had six other children, one of whom was Henry, who will occur again in this narrative. He again was quite an intellectual person. He was eventually the secretary of the RSPCA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And apparently he, like Brother Thomas later was, he was quite an active sort of follower of what he believed. He wasn't just content with sitting in his office running the affairs of the society, but he would go out and actually physically intervene where animals were being maltreated. And to complete the genealogy, Brother John Thomas married Ellen Hunt in 1834. They had a daughter, Eusebia, who married a brother, B. Lazarus. So then, we go to Brother Thomas's father. He settled in Hoxton Square, Hackney. There's a picture of Hoxton Square today. Now, in those days, Hoxton Square was a well-known centre for all these religious dissidents. In fact, it's reported that there were 25 dissenting clergy living just in this one square. So it was rather the birthplace of nonconformity in religious matters in England. So Brother John Thomas was brought up in a sort of an atmosphere of questioning existing religious beliefs. It's interesting also that in this square lived a Dr. Parkinson, lived there, who gave his name to the Parkinson's disease. And it's quite possible that he assisted in the birth of baby John. There are very few houses of Brother Thomas's day left in Hoxton Square, but there's just a couple there, which certainly date from that time. So we can imagine the Reverend Thomas taking his new bride into this house, or one like it, and raising his family there. Incidentally, in the top right-hand corner of the screen, I've put the age of Brother John Thomas relevant to each slide. I wouldn't have to keep on repeating that for you. Now, the Reverend Thomas, although he was well-educated, he was described by a contemporary as an impulsive, fickle, restless being. And so it was that he'd been appointed to the ministry in a local dissident church, but he soon fell out with the leaders of his church, and he accepted what they call in those days a call to another ministry, and this was up in Scotland, to Huntly, 40 miles north of Aberdeen. Imagine what a change that was, right up in the north of Scotland. Here's a modern picture of the street in Huntly. Don't be deceived by the nice, pleasant road there. In John Thomas's day, it was very rough and muddy and quite dirty. The actual building that they lived in is still there today, and that is the old Kirk minister's house that the Reverend Thomas took his young family to when Brother John was about 5 years old. It's interesting that in the local library there is a book which actually describes some incidents relating to Brother Thomas's family in those days. For example, in the report in this book in the library at Huntly, the writer, Robert Troop, speaking of the missionary Kirk of Huntly, he said, "Mrs. Thomas never liked Huntly. The streets were unpaved, often deep with mud and manure. The houses were all small and mean, the people uncouth, their speech scarcely intelligible to her." You can imagine someone coming up from London and being confronted with broad Scots accents. You would feel very much not at home. True to form, the Reverend Thomas fell out with his parishioners, but they arranged a meeting one day to try and settle their differences, and Mrs. Thomas was so frightened that this would result in him staying in Huntly that, as this writer records, she actually hid all his clothes early in the morning so that he couldn't go out, and the result was the meeting wasn't held, and she secured her passage back to London without any problem. But it does show a streak of determination in the family that her son had in very good measure. And so they went back to London, where the Reverend Thomas started a school in London. And here's the actual house in which he set it up in Lambeth. It was for the education of the sons of deceased congregational ministers. Now, this is where the young John Thomas had his basic education. It included all the normal subjects, obviously, English, history. In those days, Greek and Latin. And those things obviously stood our brother in very good stead in his later ministries. But he didn't learn Hebrew. So, being an enterprising young man, he bought himself a copy of Wilson's Hebrew Grammar and taught himself Hebrew from that. Shows what a resourceful and determined young man that he was. But again, the Reverend Thomas fell out with his contemporaries, this time with the parents of the school, of the children of the school that he was running. And so he accepted another call to go up north, this time to Huntly, to Chorley in Lancashire. This was, in those days, was a strong Catholic area. And one could imagine the dissident clergyman wouldn't have a very good time there. But in a book on Brother Thomas, published in New Zealand, there was a picture there of the house that they moved to. And I thought that was rather a grand house. So I did some more researches and found out actually it's a stately home. It is still there, Astley Hall in Chorley. One wonders why Brother Thomas would have gone to stay, Brother Thomas's father would have gone to stay in a home which belonged to probably some of the landed gentry. So I did a little bit of research on that and managed to contact the local library at Chorley, and they came up with the interesting information that in fact the occupants, the owner of this house at that time, did have dissident inclinations. And in fact she was a titled lady, I forget her name now. She was married to someone who actually had a dissident chapel in his house. So it is probably quite likely that the Reverend Thomas would have been welcomed even into such a grand edifice as this. But Brother Thomas never mentioned this any more than he mentioned his famous second cousin in Victorian times, William Moy Thomas. It seemed that he tried to distance himself from the nobility. He didn't want, as it were, to sort of fly under their colours. Anyway, true to form, the Reverend Thomas, after a few years in Chorley, fell out with the local Catholics this time, confronting them over what they termed the seven sacraments, the seven Christian sacraments. The Reverend Thomas, and quite rightly, I believe, alleged that there were only two sacraments, baptism and the breaking of bread. And so he wrote a pamphlet by the Reverend John Thomas, An Examination of the Seven Sacraments of the Church of Rome. And that made the Reverend Thomas investigate baptism, and he came to the view that it was immersion, not sprinkling. And he obviously discussed this with his son John, and it had, no doubt, a long-lasting effect on the young man. Well, while they're up at Chorley, John Thomas was apprenticed to a local surgeon. And when the family moved back again to London, as they inevitably did, after his father quarrelled with the local people, he stayed on at Chorley, but then became a medical. He joined them back in London and became a medical student at St Thomas's Hospital. Here is a picture of St Thomas's Hospital in the early 19th century. It's right, I've got two under here. I've got three glasses of water now. Thank you, though, Howard. St Thomas's Hospital today, as we know, is in the embankment at Westminster on the River Thames. In those days, it was in Southwark, and was demolished to make way for one of the new railways that were being built there. So nothing of St Thomas's Hospital of Brother Thomas's day survives, except for the operating room. This is still there today as a museum, and we can imagine Brother Thomas sitting there watching the dissections being performed on the table and on the operations as well. He spent 3 years in St Thomas's, and in the end he had this certificate. Close-up will show, you see, St Thomas's Hospital, this is to certify that Mr John Thomas has diligently attended three courses of lectures in anatomy and surgery. Mr Thomas also directed and attended an anatomical demonstration during two courses. So he then became qualified as a surgeon and a demonstrator in anatomy. He wasn't at that time a doctor as such. Well, he was now back in London, a qualified doctor, so he set up a practice in Hackney. And he was obviously quite an active person because, although he was still quite young, in the course of 2 or 3 years, he contributed 8 times to the medical journal The Lancet. Here's an example of one, a reprint from The Lancet of 1832, I think it was, or thereabouts. There'd been a series running in The Lancet on the state of the mind, the immateriality of the mind. And you see, this debate was added to by John Thomas, Esquire, demonstrator of anatomy. And it shows in this reference that he hadn't abandoned the original Christian beliefs he'd been brought up with. I believe that the soul, by the soul here I mean that which shall exist after death, which is scripturally denominated a spiritual body, is substantial, i.e. an immortal creature endowed with. So what he was trying to say was that the soul which continues after death isn't some intangible spirit, but it's actually a body. But he still believed, you see, in the existence of the soul. Also at that time, living in Hackney, he produced a history of Hackney. Again, one of the characteristics of Brother Thomas comes out here, that he published things as were warts and all, because his history of Hackney turned out to be much too realistic and too truthful to ever be published. It didn't really do the little area much good. And so he was forbidden further access to the public records. So, determined as he ever was, he got all his information by going round the local cemeteries and churchyards and taking down the inscriptions on the gravestones, and so in that way built up his history of Hackney. Just one copy survives in the Hackney Library. You might just see it there. History of Hackney by John Thomas and someone else. We don't know who that was. Might have been his brother. But it does show that even in that young age, Brother Thomas was not afraid to speak out about things which he felt were wrong. Now, going back to his father, Reverend Thomas, he had now joined the Baptist Church, and restless as always, he was seized with emigration fever. And Brother Thomas agreed that they, as a family, they should go out, and he went on ahead to spy out the land. He obtained a post of a ship's surgeon on the Marquis of Wellesley, which left London on the 16th of May, and had a terrible voyage. They ended up near Newfoundland, 250 miles off course. They hit sandbanks, and everybody thought the ship was going to sink, and they were all going to be drowned. And then we have the well-known incident where Brother Thomas realised that should he die, he didn't know what his future would be. And so he made this resolution. He determined that ever he got ashore, he would never rest until he had found out the truth of the matter. Well, he arrived in New York after 8 weeks, a very long and very perilous journey. But only 3 days after him, his father arrived. Again, being impulsive, he hadn't waited for his son John to report on America. He set out himself, and he had a much better journey and arrived, as they say, within 3 weeks, and just 3 days after John Thomas, his son, had arrived. To carry out his determination to find out the truth, he first of all visited the Presbyterian Church in New York. But he wasn't satisfied with their approach. So, because he had letters of introduction from the Baptists in England, he went to Cincinnati, where there was by then quite a well-known Baptist called Alexander Campbell. He set up an organization which went under various names, the Disciples of Christ, or the Reformation, because they thought they were reforming the Baptist Church. And at the entrance to his house, which is now a heritage site, we read that here lived the leading influence in America's largest indigenous religious movement, the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, founder of Bethany College, and so on. Alexander Campbell had become to disbelieve in infant baptism, and he'd been baptized by the local Baptists, but later he split from them and founded his own church, as this plaque describes. So Brother Thomas and the Reverend Thomas stayed with him, but also there was a Major Daniel Garneau. He again was a very intelligent man. He was a lawyer. He was, in fact, clerk to the Supreme Ohio Court, very prestigious post. He too was a follower of Alexander Campbell, a Campbellite. And while he was there, he met with yet another Campbellite, Walter Scott. Walter Scott tackled the young Dr. John Thomas one evening and asked him whether he'd been baptised. He obviously said, well, yes, I've been christened. And Walter Scott said, well, that's not baptism. And he pointed out all the New Testament references which showed that baptism was complete immersion. And then he said to John Thomas, well, don't you think you ought to be baptised? And Father Thomas agreed. And so they went down to the Miami Canal at Cincinnati, where Major Walter Scott baptised John Thomas into, not into Christ, but into just a sect, as Brother Thomas later says. When he was with the Campbells and the Major Garneau, he probably met Major Garneau's wife's cousin, Ellen Hunt, whom he later married. They married when John Thomas was 29. The picture there is a few years before. And the picture is the only one we have of Ellen Thomas, but one contemporary person said the doctor had one of the best wives. Being friendly with the Garneaus, or related to them, whenever Brother Thomas went on his long journeys of preaching, which we'll be mentioning in a moment, then she used to stay with her relatives, the Garneaus. Then the pair moved to Richmond in Virginia. But also before that, they stayed for a while at Alexander Campbell's house. The house is still there, been greatly restored, but it hasn't been altered significantly from when Brother Thomas was resident there. As I say, it's now a heritage site. So he set up in his own house at Richmond, set up a medical practice. But one thing had happened a little while earlier was that when he was staying with the Campbells, Alexander Campbell one day said to him, well, we've got a meeting and you're going to speak this evening. And that rather flummoxed the young Dr. Thomas. But he did the best that he could. He couldn't get out of it. He remembered having read from Rollin's Ancient History about the four empires of the ancient world, and he related that to Daniel chapter 2, and apparently gave a very good exposition, sort of off the cuff, of that chapter. So much so that he was now in quite a bit of demand as a speaker. But he felt completely inadequate. So he wanted to spend much of his time studying the scriptures to see whether he could preach more effectively. And so it means that his medical practice in this house at Richmond, Virginia, suffered very much. He tended to devote his time to Bible studies rather than to his patients. In fact, one local doctor commented, "What a fool Dr. Thomas is. If he would only devote himself to his profession, he would ride in the finest carriage in Richmond." But that was Brother Thomas in pursuit of the truth. Alexander Campbell requested him to start a publication on the Reformation, as they called their movement. And Brother Thomas chose the title The Apostolic Advocate. And the first issue was in May 1834. He had to write most of it himself, of course. And that started him on a course that led to a breach with the Campbellites. Because in only the sixth issue of the Apostolic Advocate, he published an article which he had written entitled Anabaptism. Anna is the Greek word for again. So that means re-baptism, baptized again. And it not only denied infant baptism, but Brother Thomas was preaching that all who had been sprinkled needed to be baptized into a faith based on knowledge. And that offended many Campbellites. A lot of them hadn't been re-baptized on joining the organization from the Baptists. So Brother Thomas wrote there, immersion is not baptism. It depends on an understanding of the gospel. So this develops an antagonism with Campbell, which develops further as Brother Thomas gradually unearthed the truth. Well, soon he broke with Campbell completely and preached in this meeting place at Painesville. And he began to attract quite a bit of support. But at the end of the year 1836, he moved to a farm 28 miles away, hoping that he could support his family better by farming than by his medical practice, which was declining. And it was declining only because of his biblical studies and his writing. And in another issue of the Apostolic Advocate, he asked a series of 34 questions under the heading of Information Wanted. And you see the questions were, there were 34 of them, these are a selection. Is man naturally immortal, or is immortality a gift from God? If at death a man be instantly translated to heaven or hell, how can he be said to be dead and rise again? Does not the promise to Abraham refer to the personal possession of Canaan under the personal reign of the Messiah? You see how he's been to unearth some of the fundamentals of the truth that we understand today. Well, this caused great offence in the Campbellite community because they regarded it as a declaration of his beliefs rather than just a request for information, which they were unable to supply. But it did make him study even further. And he was encouraged by the support of a few. He had several debates with Alexander Campbell on the mortality of man, the state of the dead, the resurrection of the dead, but they didn't ever agree. Now, in 1839-40, Brother Thomas and his family again relocated. This time he went to a farm way out in the Midwest, in Long Grove, Illinois, near the southern tip of Lake Michigan, to be near his brother-in-law. First he went out to spy out the land on his own, on horseback. He travelled 900 miles in 23 days. He says that he was toiling day after day over mountains, through swamps, and the newly opened wilderness, existing upon everlasting eggs and bacon, half-baked dough and homemade coffee. Well, that was his life for 23 days on that journey. But there was one notable place he did visit, which is called Hawk's Nest Gorge. It's still there today as a tourist attraction. And Brother Thomas says that he has exclaimed at this spot, "Great and wonderful are thy works, O Lord God Almighty. Who would not fear thee and glorify thy name?" It shows that he had the scriptures always in his mind, even at that comparatively young age. And Brother Robert says he was a great observer and possessed an extraordinary taste for the sublime in nature. Well, he bought a farm in Yorkville in Illinois, and then he returned to Virginia to his house and family, wife and family, after 3 months. Then they all moved by covered wagon, a 2 month journey. They camped each night in the woods, he says. When they arrived, there was no house on the new farm, so the first thing he had to do was to build one while he suspended the publication of the Apostolic Advocate. But after 6 months of farming, the doctor decided that the work was too isolating and left little time for writing. So they left the farm in the hands of someone else, and moved 25 miles away to St. Charles. And here the Brother Thomas commenced the publication of a weekly newspaper. And also there he became president and lecturer in chemistry in the newly founded Franklin Medical College, and it was that where he obtained his doctorate. But even so, that wasn't working out as he wanted. So in October 1842, he decided to sell the farm through an agent, and he went back to the East Coast to renew his acquaintance with Major Gaynor and Walter Scott. He attended Campbellite meetings, but at first they didn't recognise him, as the outdoor life and hard work on the farm had aged him so much. But when he was back with the Campbellites, he continued his studies of the word, writing and debating about it. He then commenced, on his own initiative this time, a magazine, The Herald of the Future Age. And by now he was beginning to uncover the truth as we understand it. And in 1844 to 45, he was slowly gaining supporters for the things he preached in America and in the UK. They published The Herald of the Future Age, and here it is. And see, from the title page, it's Herald of the Future Age, a non-sectarian periodical devoted to ancient Christianity and to the illustration of the new constitution of the Kingdom of Israel and of the world in the future dispensation. You see, we've got all the basic fundamentals of the truth as we know it there, haven't we? And that's what he set out to publish in this magazine. But one thing his studies had made him realise was that when he was baptised by Walter Scott in that canal in Cincinnati, he had no idea of what the true hope was. So he hadn't been truly baptised at all. So he arranged for his rebaptism. That was in 1847. And he said to a Confederate, "I desire you to immerse me. All I ask of you is to put me under the water and pronounce the words over me. Upon confession of your faith in the things concerning the kingdom of God and the name of Jesus Christ, I baptize you into the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I don't ask you for any prayer or any ceremony. All that is necessary I will do for myself, except the mechanical part of putting me in the water and the utterance of these words." And that proved a watershed in another sense, because thus, he said, "After a journey of 14 years, I had found the truth, which on the ocean I declared I would not rest till I had found, should I be permitted again to tread on terra firma. But," he says, "in all this journey, I've been directed in a course very different from what I would have selected if I'd been left it out to map it out for myself." So he recognised the hand of providence. So then, here was Brother Thomas now, a fairly well-known Christian figure, and he now had a complete understanding. And he felt obliged to issue what he called his confession, abjuration, and declaration, so that everybody knew from then on just where he stood. A confession, dictionary definition, of formal acknowledgement of past wrongs, and despite his respect for Scripture, induced by a godly and pious mother, as he describes her, he had listened to the words of men rather than God, was previously immersed without knowing the true hope. And then he abjured, which is to announce past wrongs. He renounced much of what he had once taught, immortal soul, heaven going, baptism without knowledge, and so on. And he then made a declaration of his newfound faith, a formal statement, and he sets out the truth largely as we know it today. And this was another turning point in his life, because that publication of that resulted in his final break with Alexander Campbell. Now, having found the truth, the rest of his life he devoted to preaching the truth which he had found. So soon after, he went on a preaching tour of throughout North America, ending in New York, where he gave 10 lectures which were very successful, so much so that the people there offered him a paid preaching post to be their minister, but he refused. He said, "We cannot afford to sell our independence for a mess of pottage." Well, at this time that Brother Thomas visited Great Britain, he sailed with his daughter, Eusebia, on the DeWitt Clinton, had a good voyage this time, crossed the Atlantic in 3 weeks, and he was given a letter of introduction to the Campbellite community in Britain. But they'd obviously been forewarned about him, so they refused to have him at their meetings. But there was another group there, the followers of a certain Miller. Oh, by the way, I should have put that one in first, yes. This is a picture of him, that how he was at 43, his first visit to Britain. He said, "The one thing that interested me was the speaker's beard, which was a novelty in those days." That was a young 9-year-old Robert Roberts, who listened to him in one of his preaching talks. But the William Miller, he was the leader of the Millerites in those days, became the Seventh-day Adventists. Now, he had previously insisted that Christ would return in 1843. When he didn't come, by 1848, many of his followers were disconsolate, and they were ready to listen to Brother Thomas. And in Nottingham, 30 of them left the Millerites, Seventh-day Adventists, to form the first Christadelphian Ecclesia. So he then went on to Glasgow, where he gave 10 lectures in the Old College Church, Glasgow, which has since been demolished. And then he went on to the City Hall in Glasgow, where he gave 4 lectures to an audience of 5,000 each time. And they were so impressed with what he was saying that they asked that they could have his views in a more written form, especially as he was soon going back to America and they wouldn't be able to contact him again. He then went on to Edinburgh, where in the Assembly Rooms, the Waterloo Place, Edinburgh, he gave 10 lectures, again, very successful ones. And that was followed by another request for a book. That building, incidentally, is now Travelodge. It's still there, but there it is. Changed its nature, certainly. So, to carry out this request to have a book, he went down to London to stay with his brother Henry. And he lived in Budnall Place in North London. Now, I was able to locate the site of the house occupied by Henry Thomas, but unfortunately it had been pulled down and is occupied by a modern block of flats. But just down the road are some houses that still date from Brother Thomas's time. So we can imagine Brother Thomas living in a house like this, sleeping upstairs, going downstairs for his meals, and spending all his time writing Help Is Israel. He says of that, "I worked while it was called day and much of the night also. For 6 weeks, the world without was a mere blank. For during that period, I had no use for hat, boots or shoes, oscillating as it were like a pendulum between two points, the couch above and the desk beneath." In about 4 months, the manuscript was completed. Just imagine writing a book like Help Is Israel. We know it is, what, it's 400 or 500 pages. All done by hand. All his reference books were back home in America. And yet what a monumental work it is. It shows what a great literary ability he had and a great understanding, too, of Scripture. It might be worth, at this point, saying a word about his style. people today find it difficult to read, but it was quite usual in those days. And also it was quite antagonistic. That was customary. Brother Robert says, "These writings were so pungent, so vigorous, so satirical, and had such a sledgehammer force of argument and denunciation." But that was his public, his written work. "But to talk to," says Brother Roberts, "he was quiet, gentle, courteous, devoid of affectation, and no trace of self-importance." What a testimonial. Well, whilst Elpis Israel was being printed, he did another tour of England preaching, and part of that tour he went up to Aberdeen. And in this building was a chapel, now a restaurant. He lectured, and young Brother Robert Roberts was in the audience, a nine-year-old, where he was intrigued only by his black beard. But even so, as a result of this preaching tour, many supportive groups were established in Great Britain. Having, as it were, founded the truth in England, Brother Thomas went back to America, to his house at Richmond. He resumed the herald of the kingdom and age to come. But he was very unwell. His travels were beginning to tell on him, but he didn't give up. He continued his preaching. He describes the two extremes which his preaching took. It was either on a soapbox in the open air, or alternatively, in the Virginia State House, and you couldn't have a better building than that, the central capital of the state, and in the old Hall of Delegates, which is still there, which was their parliament of those days. That was the room in which Brother Thomas lectured for several evenings. Three evenings there. It's almost as if today one of us would go and lecture in the House of Commons, isn't it? Fancy speaking to all the delegates in the state legislature. Then he started tours in Eastern America by horse or by coach along what he described as torrent-wasted gullies called roads. He even went up by boats of Canada to Halifax, travelled over 1,000 miles in all in that year. And then in 1852, he moved to New York, where he set up the first Ecclesia in America, just as we know it today. Breaking of bread in the morning, lecture in the evening. There were 6 members at first, but within a few years it had grown to over 50. He established an ecclesial constitution similar to what we have today. So he was really founding the truth in its, all its practical as well its doctrinal aspects. Here's the place where they met, in the Cooper Union Hall. Incidentally, it's the first steel-framed building erected in America. And there they met in one of the rooms under the name of the Royal Association of Believers. Then in 1854, he had many more travels. By this time, railways were beginning to spread across America. And here's an example of one called the John Bull. This is a sort of train that Brother Thomas would have used in the 1850s. It continued to, wasn't taken out of service until 1866, so he may well have actually travelled on this one. And by train he went right across to central USA, to the Mississippi, where he travelled 400 miles on what he describes as an overcrowded riverboat, up the Mississippi to Cincinnati, and then on the Mississippi up to Louisville, preaching at every stop. In 1855 to 1856, again another 1,000-mile trip to Kentucky, again by train, but he said it was pulled by a locomotive that, as it went, became, to use his words, exceedingly asthmatical, imagine it puffing away. It took 78 hours, an average speed of 12 miles an hour. They're very crowded in those days too. And Brother Thomas records how, on one occasion, when he saw the crowds waiting on the platform, the train was still in the siding, he slipped out, climbed into the train through an open window, and ensconced himself in one of the compartments, so when the train pulled into the platform, he already had a seat. So he's quite a resourceful man as well. Anyway, in that trip to Kentucky, he did 30 hours of preaching, and then he went north up into Canada, where in the St. Lawrence Hall, Toronto, he preached on Sundays. On the left you've got the hall as it is today, and inside it's been restored as it was in the 19th century style. So probably very much like that when Brother Thomas was there. That was on Sundays. Weekdays he lectured at the Temperance Hall in Toronto. About this time there was another development. There was a Jew in New York called Dr. DeLara, and he queried Brother Thomas in a very friendly way on the nature of God, about whether it was unity or trinity. And that set Brother Thomas thinking and prompted him to expound what is now one of our basic doctrines and our unique doctrine that we have, that of God manifestation. And as a result, he wrote Phanerosis. So let's summarise his preaching travels in that decade. 1850, back to America. 51, preaching to the eastern seaboard. 54, settled in New York, established the ecclesia. Again, went to Mississippi. The next year, a 1,000-mile trip to Kentucky. Next year, up to Toronto. The next year, discussion with Christian Jews and preaching in the Deep South. 58, repeated visits to Canada and Kentucky. 59, more visits to Kentucky and Virginia. 1860, Kentucky and Mississippi again. He covered about 20,000 miles, delivered hundreds of addresses, and still found time to edit and to write extensively for the Herald and publish it every month. What an achievement for that was. This shows the major towns that he visited. All the black dots represent the towns. I haven't put the names in all of them because it would be too cluttered. But you can see there Richmond on the coast, where he was based, New York, where he established the ecclesia, Toronto, where he lectured. Notice that little place, Ogle, out by Lake Michigan, on the left of the screen there. That was where he, near there, he first tried to set up his farm. In 1861, he published the first volume of Eureka. Volume 2 was published actually 5 years later, in 1866. But the way they financed publication in those days, you get someone to, or everybody to subscribe and pay in advance, or in this case, a brother Samuel Kaufman, who lived near that place, Ogle. He underwrote the production, supplied the money in the hope that he would get it back when the book was sold. And he did that for both of the volumes of Eureka. And a little bit more about Brother Kaufman in a moment. Now, what was happening now was that the Civil War was commencing in America. We know what that was. It was the issues over slavery, the North versus the South. They were fighting against each other, and the production of the Herald was suspended. So Brother Thomas took the occasion to visit Britain again. This time he stayed with Robert Roberts at Huddersfield and visited Halifax, Leeds, Edinburgh, Birmingham, Nottingham and London. And Brother Roberts describes him at that time. Here he is during his second stay in Britain. Brother Roberts describes him. It's impossible to exaggerate the charm of Dr. Thomas's company under our own roof. He was a totally different man from what his writings prepared us to expect. Instead, he was quiet, gentle, courteous, well-mannered, modest, absolutely devoid of affectation or trace of self-importance. His calm, lofty reverence for scriptures was very edifying, as were his fireside answers to the various scriptural questions we had to propound. "Let me see," he would say, "where is that passage?" and would turn it up and then proceed in his dignified and incisive way to open to us the scriptures. Well, these are the places that Brother Thomas visited during his second visit to Britain. A 9-month tour, going throughout Scotland, England and Wales, as you can see. In the Mumbles down there in South Wales, he preached in this chapel and converted the whole of the congregation to Christadelphians. And it still is there today as a Christadelphian hall. What a legacy. Well, he returned to America in the February of 63, back to New York. But then the problem of slavery was becoming a real problem. Here's an advert for the selling of slaves down in the southern states. The unionists in the north wanted to abolish slavery. The Confederates in the south wanted to retain it. And Brother Thomas was there in New York. There was a demarcation line between the two states, which they didn't allow people to cross. And down in Richmond and that area were most of his supporters, and he wanted to support them. It was also a centre of the Confederate armies, and so travelling was very difficult. The frontier between North and South was closed, and Brother Thomas was cut off from those in the South. But Providence was at work. He wanted to go South, so he had some contacts down the South, who were prepared... I should have shown you that one. That is the demarcation line between the North and the South states, with the Unionists in the North and the Confederates in the South. On his journey south, he had letters of introduction. "My friend Dr. Thomas of New Jersey wishing to visit Virginia in connection with his churches. It gives me pleasure to introduce him to you as a gentleman in every respect." Or again, another one, "a gentleman in every way, worthy of commendation." And that was from the commanders down at the south. And so when he got to the border, he obviously was allowed across. When it came going back again to cross the border the second time, there was a brother down south called Brother McGruder, who was a very loyal supporter of Brother Thomas, and been so for 20 years. He was a prominent lawyer in the town. In fact, he was a friend of the President Lincoln. And he had a brother, who was General McGruder, who was actually in charge of that demarcation line. And so General McGruder wrote a letter to ensure that Brother Thomas was able to safely get across the line. And he went under a flag of truce, and so he arrived safely back. Going back to our map, I've arrowed there the little place called Ogle. Now, that's where Brother Kaufman had his farm. We've already mentioned him as the one who supported the production of Eureka. It was a large farm of 800 acres, and Brother Thomas went to stay there. Now, it was while he was staying at this house, Cold Spring Farm. Here's a derelict picture of the actual building. That conscription was introduced, and all the young eligible men were being called up for army service. And the brethren asked what he should do, so he arranged to have a petition submitted to the authorities, and wanting to have a single name to describe us rather than the Royal Association of Believers that had been known as until then, he coined the term Christadelphian. So imagine him sitting up in one of those rooms, maybe cogitating and coming up with the name Brethren of Christ. It was quite a Christadelphian community there, actually, because Samuel Kaufman's brother was an ex-minister and very keen Christadelphian. And even in the grounds of the farm, there's a baptismal bath which they used to use. Because he had a lot of farm, Brother Kaufman set aside part of it for the cemetery. And here is actually his memorial in there. And it was here that Brother Thomas said he would like to be buried, because Brother Kaufman had been such a fervent supporter from him. Well, in the next few years, Brother Thomas had more extensive preaching tours, mainly now to support and consolidate the ecclesias. As I said, Eureka 2 was published, but his health was beginning to deteriorate. So in 1868, after Eureka 3 had been published, he made his third visit to Britain. He revisited most of the ecclesias of his second visit, and we're told that he exhibited the truth in 145 discourses. Imagine giving 145 lectures on the truth. And now, for those days, quite an elderly man and not a very well man. If I can make a personal allusion, he preached in Swansea, in this place, which is still there, the Albert Hall. And there it is that the grandfather of my dear wife first heard the truth from Brother Thomas and came into the truth, for which we're very, very thankful. Well, as a result of this visit, Brother Thomas decided to settle permanently back in England. He even decided on plans for a new house, bought the plot, and Brother Roberts, in his notes, describes just where it was. It was in a place, 21 St. Bernard's Road, Solihull, Boingham, near the little village of Alton, as it was then. It was a brand new area. In fact, the local public record says a new road was constructed, St. Bernard's Road, in 1870. The first house to be constructed in the road is thought to be Elmhurst, number 21. Now, that was the house which Brother Thomas commissioned for it to be his final abode when he came back to England. But, in fact, he never saw it completed, as we'll see in a moment. But it was used, actually, for a major fraternal a couple of years later. And as this report goes on to say, it was used for a gathering of 200 people in 1872. And some of you might know that rather famous picture of a group of 200 Christadelphians in the garden of an old house. Well, that was the house that Brother Thomas originally planned to build. Well, he went back to the USA and did another tour. He was going to settle up all his affairs and come back to England, but he did one ecclesial tour comparatively locally. He planned to go to Canada to preach, but he had to give up because of his ill health. He said, "Our weakness is extreme, our bulk reduced to mere bone and attenuated muscle." And so in 1871, on the 5th of March, he died. His daughter, Sister Lazius, wrote, "His illness lasted 8 days of excruciating agony. He sank into a state of coma. At last, half an hour past midnight, he sank to rest as quietly as a child." In his will, he had deputed Robert Roberts from Scotland and Thomas Bosher from London to take his funeral. We know of Brother Robert Roberts, and we hear more about him, God willing, in a fortnight's time. Probably we don't know so much about Thomas Bosher, but he was a very respected brother in London. In fact, his legacy today is in our hymn book, because he wrote the hymn, "Jehovah Dwells Alone, No Equal Can He See," a hymn which we often enjoy singing even to this day. Well, because the ground was frozen, and because Brother Roberts would take a while to come, Brother Thomas was interred in a vault in the local cemetery, Jersey City. And Brother Roberts describes how when he got to America with Brother Bosher, the attendant opened that door and they went down some steps into an underground chamber. And there was the coffin of Brother Thomas, and he got the attendant to unscrew the lid, and he saw for the last time the beloved face of the one whom he esteemed so much. Brother Thomas had said in advance, "When I die, make no commotion, just put me out of sight." But he had set out the procedure that he wanted adopted. And he was buried in Greenwood Cemetery on the 30th of April. I would like to acknowledge the help of Brother John Miller, whom some of you might remember now of the Swansea meeting, who last year went out to America, visited the grave at New York, and kindly let me have these slides. It's a wonderful cemetery, actually, beautifully laid out. And there, unfortunately, these colours aren't showing out nicely. That central column of Brother Thomas's tomb is, in fact, a lovely bright pink. I don't know how it shows in your version on the screen, but it doesn't matter anyway. We've got it there. Brother Roberts, we can imagine him there with Brother Bosher and a few of the local Christadelphians. He carried out the ceremony exactly as Brother Roberts had requested. The readings, the words, and so laid him to rest. Little did Robert Roberts know that he would eventually join Brother Thomas on the same spot. And there is his tomb on the left-hand side, and that of Sister Thomas and Sister Eusebia Lasius, the daughter, on the right-hand side. The inscription reads as follows. "Here lies in brief repose, waiting the return of the Lord from heaven, John Thomas, M.D., author of Elpis Israel, Eureka, Anastasis, Phanerosis and other works, in which he demonstrated the unscriptural character of popular Christianity and made manifest the long-lost faith of the apostles, and left behind him a body of people known as Christadelphians to continue the work begun." Truly one thinks of the words of the Apostle Paul, "Study to show thyself approved, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth." And certainly that applies to our beloved brother Thomas. But the important thing is that last phrase, isn't it? People known as Christadelphians to continue the work begun. And that is now our responsibility, to maintain that faith which he unearthed, both in faith and in practice. Certainly he was a man raised up by God. Throughout his life he acknowledged that, and looking back we can see how God was with him all his life, gradually bringing him to the state of knowing the truth and being able to preach it to others. And so we give thanks to the Almighty for our brother John Thomas. He mentions there that the resurrection at the return of Jesus, and we can be pretty sure that he will then receive that accolade from the Master. "Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord."